Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom in crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to the Savvy Shrink.
Welcome to the Savvy Shrink. My guest today is Christine Louis de Cannonville. Christine Louis de Cannonville is an author, psychotherapist, supervisor, external examiner, lecturer, and specialist in narcissistic victim syndrome. She worked in the trauma unit of St. Brendan Psychiatric Hospital in Ireland and has worked specifically with victims of narcissistic abuse, both in her private practice and internationally for many years. Much of Christine's knowledge has come from her postgraduate studies in criminology and forensic psychology, and it is through these disciplines that she has gained her understanding of the dark triad, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy, better understood by health providers under the terms of the narcissist, malignant narcissist, and psychopath. These three faces of evil are vital information for understanding the full spectrum of narcissistic abuse. It is her vision that narcissistic abuse becomes part of the curriculum of all mental health professionals and other professionals who deal with the fallout of this insidious abuse. Professionals such as psychotherapists, social workers, police, doctors, solicitors, law courts, and human resources management. We're so honored to have you here today, Christine. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Andrea. And I'm very happy to be speaking to you from my bed in Dublin.
Oh, it's just so wonderful to have you here and such an honor. You're one of the pioneers in the field of narcissistic abuse recovery. And we're very excited today to speak with you about the difference between co-narcissism versus codependency in victims of narcissistic abuse. So this is going to be an interesting conversation.
Okay, it is indeed.
Much of what is written about narcissistic abuse speaks of the victim as being codependent. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with the fact that a lot of people are writing that victims are codependents. But actually, no, that has not been my experience working with the amount of victims that I've worked with. Now, of course, there is a possibility occasionally you may be dealing with that. But generally speaking, that has not been my experience, no.
Okay. So we see online there's so much that people are writing about. Unfortunately, it seems that there's a lot of victim shaming and blaming where we hear the word codependent sort of thrust upon victims or survivors of narcissistic abuse. So it's really interesting to hear from one of the pioneers in the field that that label doesn't always fit for survivors.
I think it is a very shaming title to put on the victim. Unfortunately, I feel that some of the clinicians, especially those that are working in the area of addiction settings, I think they tend to fall into the trap of labeling the victim as codependent. And I think that is a shame. It really is a shame that they're doing that, because I think it's the wrong diagnosis. And I really would like that to be addressed. And I've got a feeling that what's happening is, you know, most therapists have not been trained in narcissistic abuse or, you know about the victims of narcissistic abuse. And I think what's happening is, I think a lot of therapists are trying to inform themselves. So they're, you know, they're educating themselves by reading articles. And I think what's happening is, when people are writing articles, because they're seeing it written, they're also dating it, but they haven't actually maybe challenged that diagnosis themselves. Now, that's what I'm thinking anyway.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with you. I think I've found that to be the case too, where unfortunately the term codependent seems to be misdiagnosed or inappropriately assigned to survivors. And I feel like that pulls a lot of the victims down in their recovery process because they're wrestling with self-blame for being in that kind of relationship as it is, as a result of all the gaslighting and all of the projection and blame shifting that's happened from the perpetrator.
Yes, I'd agree. I'd agree with that completely. And yeah. I don't think that the therapists do fully understand the effects of the abuse on the victim. And because if they did, I don't think they would be actually so quick to say that it's codependency.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we're both kind of in agreement there, you and I both. And you, of course, quite a lot of work with victims as well.
Yes, I do. And you inspire me, really. You were one of the first people I read your work online, and you're one of the pioneers. So it's just so exciting to be able to have this conversation. Absolutely. I do see a lot of people in my practice that are survivors of narcissistic abuse, and the vast majority do come in with a sense of very low self-worth because they think they're codependent. And so, you know, that may be the case for some, but the vast majority I work with are not codependent, and they're truly survivors of this trauma bond they've experienced with a horrific perpetrator. And so that brings me to my next question for you. I would love to learn more this notion. I know when you speak, you sometimes use the term co-narcissist when you talk about victims of narcissistic abuse. And what do you see as the difference between a codependent and a co-narcissist? That's a really interesting concept that I think not a lot of clinicians know much about.
Okay. Well, first of all, I do think that there's a huge difference between the co-narcissist and the codependent. But before maybe I answer that, would it be okay if I maybe deviate it slightly?
Absolutely.
The term co-narcissist, I kind of discovered that maybe 3 years or so ago. It wasn't a term I came up with, by the way. I came across an article by Alan Rappoport, I think it's the way it's pronounced. He's an American psychotherapist, and he coined the term. And I have to be honest, when I first came across it, because for your listeners, not only am I a psychotherapist, but I actually suffered narcissistic abuse. And I grew up with a psychopathic brother, so I was very much in the worst of it, really, to be honest. So when I first came across the term co-narcissist in relation to me, I had a kind of a reaction, and it wasn't a good reaction at first. But I also thought, well, that's such a strong reaction in me. I wonder what there is that I need to learn from that. And so I started to dig deeper, really. I was also, at the same time, I had quite a few victims contact me through my website, and some of them were objecting to the term victim. They didn't like the term that I was using, victim. And so I was trying to find maybe another term that people wouldn't feel, you know, that we'd be more comfortable with. So basically, really, it was researching to try and find a new title, that how I came across Alan's work and came up with this term, co-narcissist. So the way I actually felt that, of course, I went off on my own kind of journey of research into even my own past, whatever it was. And I came up with I started to compare, okay, co. What are we talking about with co? Let's break it all down. And then I came up with the analogy of the pilot drives a plane, and he always has a co-pilot. Now, the pilot is the one, obviously, who is the dominant one, and the co-pilot assists and, you know, is very much there with them driving the plane. I thought, okay, right. In my case, my perpetrator was the narcissist. Therefore, I was the co-narcissist. So there was this, if you like, this convoluted dance that went on between the two of us. And then I started to think, well, okay, I can run with this. This is looking a little bit more now like maybe there is something in this. One thing that I disagreed with Alan, and in case Alan, you're listening, I hope I got your name right. Alan said that he came up with this term associated with children who were being reared by a narcissistic parent.
Right.
And of course, a lot of children are. In my case, it wasn't a parent. My parents were loving parents. My problem was a sibling. So I started to look much deeper into all of that area as well. And actually what I found was that A narcissist can be anyone who a child who is an authority figure to a child. So it can be a sibling, it can be a grandparent, could be an aunt, uncle, it could be the scoutmaster, it could be the teacher, it could be the priest at the school. It could be anyone where they have an authority over the child. So I would like to say that I wouldn't confine it only to a parent. But where I would go along with Alan is, I think it's a very good term. It's looking like a good term, at least for us to begin with, when we're talking about early narcissistic abuse, so that it's a long term. It begins in childhood. And of course, then that dance is well and truly conditioned in that victim child.
I think that's a very eloquent way of describing it. And that's a very clear picture for our listeners. So thank you for spelling that out. It makes great sense to me.
Right. Now you come on to asking me, what are the differences? Well,
yes.
When I started to look at the codependent and then what my understanding was becoming around the co-narcissist, I found that there were a lot of inconsistencies. I actually think calling a co-narcissist, now when we'll talk about the co-narcissist now, we know we're talking about a victim, especially one as a child. And I think it's a bit of a lazy diagnosis. I don't think the clinicians have really looked into it deep enough themselves. Otherwise, they wouldn't be making that mistake. So in the dance, the narcissist dominates and the co-narcissist victim submits. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that that's a great analogy. I agree with you. Like you say, a convoluted dance. I think that's a good way to put it. And so there is truly a difference between a codependent and a co-narcissist. And the way you're describing it is the co-narcissist is like the co-pilot in the plane, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
They're both active in the dance, but the dance, a lot of people talk about the tango. Now, the tango is a very wonderful dance. If you watch a tango, the male, now when I talk about narcissists, I actually am talking about males and females. I'm not confining it only to males at all. Make that clear. But in the tango, the man leads while the female submits always to whatever way he places his body, she goes with it. So he leads the dance. And it's the same with the narcissist and the co-narcissist. The narcissist leads the dance while the co-narcissist victim submits to the dance and follows.
Aha, right. Now, that's a great visual.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I think one thing that I'd like to just remind people too about the concept of codependency, we've got to remember where that term came from. That term came out of an Alcoholic Anonymous. That's where it came from. Codependency is an excessive emotional, physical and psychological reliance upon a relationship. So it's a kind of a learned helplessness, especially in those children that grew up in alcoholic environments. Now, we can also say in a kind of a way, co-narcissism, there's a certain amount of learned helplessness in there, but it's different. It's not the same.
Yeah.
So when we're talking
with you,
you'd agree. Okay.
Yes.
So when we're looking at the characteristics of the codependent personality, we're talking about somebody who leans on other people for protection. They need to be nurtured. They're looking for safety. They need someone to assume responsibility for them. They're afraid to almost do anything on their own. These are the characteristics. That's why they're so attracted to strong types, someone who will take the control and care for them. They're clingy. And sometimes they're so clingy that they're almost to the point of suffocating their partners. When they're not being cared for, they become really quite lost and despondent. They'll do anything. So they're great at giving. They do give and they do give, but they do it to avoid rejection and abandonment because that is too painful for them. They become really enmeshed in the people that they love. And any thought of separation is likely to cause them intense anxiety. So when I talk about the characteristics of the co-narcissist, it really is quite different. So although people may see the co-narcissist as weak or passive, that's the first thing that's not the truth at all. They're not the people I work with, that I can tell you. The people that I work with, the victims that I work with, I have to say that usually I find them highly creative and highly functioning achievers. They have a certain amount of positive regard. They are definitely not looking for someone to take care of them. On the contrary, they're smart caretakers to others. And that's why there's such an attraction to the narcissist. Narcissists want to be looked after. They don't want to look after somebody else. They're looking for smart caretakers. The co-narcissists tend to be the ones, certainly the ones I'm meeting, and I'd be delighted to hear how you find it. They have unconditional love, most of them. They're very genuine. They're often quite humble. And many of them turn out to be sensitive empaths.
I would agree completely, Christine. I completely agree. The vast majority of the survivors that I work with who've been impacted by narcissistic abuse have incredible abilities with high emotional IQ and depth of empathy, compassion, integrity, accountability, compromise, all of those wonderful qualities that look like a very healthy relationship. And I believe that narcissists are really drawn to that because they're lacking that within themselves. So I agree with you that it's actually the survivor or the victim of narcissistic abuse is incredibly strong and has so many wonderful qualities within them in most circumstances that it's like a moth to a flame. The narcissist is seeking that which they don't have within them in terms of their own emotional IQ, and they want to consume that because they're lacking it. At least that's what I found in my own practice. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, we're both finding the very same thing as well. And where the narcissist, you know, appears to be very confident and come across, you know, very much in command, in the reality, they actually have quite a fragile ego. And they need people to constantly boost that ego and keep their self-esteem regulated. And they're not going to, I don't think that they're going to actually look for codependents to do that job. I think they're looking for the co-narcissist who actually is very compassionate and very excellent caretakers. So I don't, and this is where I'm seeing an, it's very inconsistent with codependency.
Right.
Now, of course,
I agree with you, Christine.
Good. Fantastic.
Yes. Of course. I do. And go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say the downside of having such, you know, the co-narcissist then has quite a strong character, really. But the downside of that is the narcissist needs to control these people. They have to be controlled in order to be malleable. You know, I am a strong-minded person, and yet my brother was able to absolutely control me with his fear, with his manipulation, sometimes seduction, not sexual, by the way, for me. But the thing is, he had to manage my strong-headedness. And he did it with mostly with fear, where the codependent wants someone to control them. I never wanted to be controlled. And most of the victims that I work with would tell you they fought back and they ended up in trouble. They ended up getting beaten back and trodden on because they did try to hold on to themselves.
Yes, absolutely. It's like that trauma bond forms, and the nature of the abuse is so insidious that the co-narcissist or the survivor doesn't know what's hit them until they start to realize that there's this devaluation or discarding that's happening, whether it's a romantic relationship, a family relationship, or a work relationship. It seems to follow the same cycle.
Yes.
And with these predators, and it is the strength of the survivor that the predator is after. And so I think what you say is so spot on, because so many survivors or co-narcissists are, you know, reeling in the aftermath of this horrific form of psychological abuse, and they already feel so down about themselves and their self-esteem is torn to shreds, that to have an additional label thrown on them like codependency, which is in most cases not even applicable, just further makes that healing process more challenging. So I think what you have to say is really illuminating and very, very empowering for survivors. And not only as a clinician, but also as a survivor yourself, having lived to tell the tale, and also now knowing on the other side of it that you do have incredible strengths within that you're proud of, that are fierce. They're a part of who you are and they make you who you are. And now knowing what you've been through, you know how to protect those parts of yourself. But at the time, as a little girl, you didn't have that opportunity. You were very much exposed to a very dangerous situation. And through that, you've been able to be an incredible pioneer in this field.
And I think it's really going to be very important for clinicians to go back if they are writing about codependency. And I will be corrected if I'm absolutely wrong. I will be. But maybe just what I'm putting out, maybe those that are writing, maybe they would go back and they would just have a look and sort of see, do they need to reevaluate? Because I think it's very important for us as clinicians to be reminded that codependent, the label codependent, was never intended to be used where there was violence, violent behavior by one person, the narcissist, against another person, the victim. It was never about that. It was actually a term that was originally meant to be applied to relationships where one person in the family had a chemical addiction and other family members were affected by that addiction. That's a very, very different thing altogether.
Absolutely. And with that, do you think it's impossible for clinicians to understand the difference between codependency and co-narcissism if they don't understand the dance of the narcissist?
I think that they definitely need to look at what we're saying at the moment, you and I, what we're both finding, and which we're talking about for the very first time ever. We haven't talked about this before. And so we're just throwing out an idea here today and inviting other therapists, please take a look, see how your findings as well. Are we actually maybe risking putting victims, what we're doing by calling them codependents? We're putting a label on them. We're more or less saying they have a personality disorder because codependency comes, it's on the fringe end of a codependent personality disorder. And, you know, we need to be careful because we're sending out a message. If we do that, if we tell our clients, I mean, a big part of working with victims, and I think you'll agree at this, is education. I know when victims come to me and we're talking, I will often say, have you heard of this term or that term? And why don't you look it up before we meet next week and see what you think? So they might go away and look up, I don't know, gaslighting or trauma bonding or whatever it is. And then we'll come back and then we'll discuss and we'll see, does it apply, or all the rest of it. And that's the way I work. So there's a certain amount of education involved in the way I work. But if we're telling people to go away and research being a codependent, we might be putting them in a very serious situation. This is what worried me the most. What we might be doing is we might be telling them that actually, if they read up about codependency, they'll see the helplessness, how they're not able to make decision making, how they're not able to problem solve, how they need strong people to mind them. That might actually make a victim decide to stay put because they might feel my abuser is right. I am useless. I am a mess. And they might believe that of themselves. So I think it's actually not only the wrong label, I actually am thinking it could be dangerous to be asking people to accept that they might be codependent.
I think you're spot on, Christine. I really do, because I feel like it just adds to more victim shaming and blaming to have an additional label that doesn't even fit the survivor or the co-narcissist. You know, in most cases, codependency doesn't seem to fit, at least with the clients that I've worked with, and it sounds like same with you. So if we use terminology that's more empowering for survivors, I think that really helps them to understand that they're extricating themselves out of this trauma bond, that the narcissistic abuse that was imposed upon them is not their fault, and that they're working very hard to understand what hit them, what landmine they stepped on. And for sure, that psychoeducation is so critically important to help dismantle cognitive dissonance that remains in the aftermath of this form of abuse. So I think what you have to say about, you know, co-narcissism versus codependency is actually a really critical piece of empowering the survivor to move forward with confidence, knowing that they have tremendous emotional IQ in most circumstances and a lot of strengths to be able to protect and reclaim in the future. You're looking at the situation.
Well, I think another thing that maybe therapists need to understand the dance that goes on between the narcissist and the co-narcissist, I think they need to really familiarize themselves with the defense mechanisms that the survivor has to use, because The narcissist uses ambient abuse and coercive control. These are patterns of behaviors that I see in all of my victims. And yes. So my victims or my co-narcissists have been subjected to threats, assault, humiliation, intimidation, manipulation, and a host of other things. And so the ambient abuse makes them fearful. They get them fearful, and then they break them down bit by bit with the coercive control, where they isolate them from other people, where they literally make them doubt themselves about whether they dress properly, whether, you know, some of my clients even weren't allowed to choose when they slept. They could sleep when they were told they could sleep. Sometimes they had to stay up all night because the narcissist wanted to stay up all night for whatever reason. And they made their victims stay up with them, that they weren't allowed to sleep. But yet in the morning, the narcissist would sleep late, but they'd expect their co-narcissist partner to get up and get the children off to school as if they'd had a full night's sleep. So they're worn down bit by bit by bit. And this is all part of the dance.
Yes.
If therapists don't understand, it's very different from codependency.
Yes, I agree completely. And it needs to be a part of grad school curriculum for clinicians. So important, because so many clinicians do not understand how to help survivors or co-narcissists in the aftermath of narcissistic or even psychopathic abuse.
Yeah.
And so I know you're diligently on training therapists and clinicians over. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's about and if it sort of dovetails into this kind of discussion that we're having today?
In some ways, yes. I suppose in a way, although I might not have realized it, I think I am actually writing about the dance, although I'm not talking, the book itself is actually about shame.
Mm-hmm.
And my working title at the moment, and it may well become the title, is When Shame Begets Shame. So I'm looking, it's a primer. It's for therapists and victims alike. So it's not a heavy book. It's not written in intense or language or anything like that. I've tried to keep it as simple as I can and yet at the same time informative. So it's basically looking at, I suppose, where it's coming from. I'm seeing narcissism is essentially a shame coping response to childhood narcissistic wounding. So narcissists themselves have been victims as children, and their woundedness actually has left them very, very shame-based and shame-prone. And so this, I think, gets acted out on the victim. When they pick their supply person, their co-narcissist, then the narcissist themselves cannot abide shame or being shamed. They can't handle it. It completely destroys them. So they project any shame that they have outward onto their victims. So their victims do become very, very shame prone, or certainly they're dealing with a great deal of shame, because for the victim, the narcissist's shame is very contagious, and it resonates with their own sense of failure and disappointment. And they also use unconscious defense mechanisms to conceal their shame. So, like, for instance, in my own self, I thought for years, for absolute years, that I was a shy person. And I'm not good in the limelight. I hate being in the limelight, which is unfortunate for someone who's trying to do what I'm trying to do at the moment, workshops and talks and things like that. But what I didn't know myself, because it never ever came up in my therapy ever, that actually it wasn't so much shyness as it was shame. So I didn't want to be in the limelight, because I could never take my brother's limelight. If I did, it was a dangerous place to be. If I outshone him, or if I took the attention away from him, then there was danger in that for me. So that's one of the reasons why I don't like being in the limelight. But also, you know, one of the things about narcissists, when you're a victim of a narcissist, you have to be a perfectionist. You have to be. You're made to be, because the narcissist sees you as representing them. And you have got to get everything right, because if you don't get anything right for some reason or other, they feel that it reflects badly on them. So in a way, it's instilled in you to, you're second guessing, you're always trying to make sure you don't get things wrong. And when is enough enough? Do I know enough? And what about the bit I don't know? So these are all the places I go into whenever I'm asked to even do an interview. Oh my God, you know, do I know enough? And what if I don't know enough? What if I get it wrong? And of course, right, that's all coming from the shame that was projected onto me, which I swallowed, interjected. Mm. I didn't do it deliberately. I didn't know I was doing it. But I was doing it. So my book is dealing with the dance in the sense of how the narcissist shame, how that gets projected out, and how that gets internalized in the victim. And then how the victim dances around that. So like in my case, I avoided being in the spotlight. Not because I'm stupid, because I'm not stupid, but because it was dangerous. Because if I got something wrong, I was going to be humiliated. And I was humiliated. And unconsciously, of course, I brought it into my adulthood. But I did I know? No, I didn't. I actually didn't know. And it never came up in therapy. So a big part of the therapy, I think, has to look at the shame. I mean, I worked with a wonderful lady who had a narcissistic mother, and she's incredible and a professional and earns quite a lot of money, and she's top of her game. And she wrote a book, and she sat on her book for 5 years. And in the meantime, somebody else who wouldn't be as good as her has written a book similar to the one she had written. And when we explored, well, you know, why did you not want to have it published? She did want to have it published, but she didn't realize that actually that was going to throw her out into the limelight. And she didn't want the limelight, but she didn't know that.
Hmm.
So that was the shame of whenever she got things wrong at home with mom, her mom would humiliate her and tell her how stupid she was and you know, pull her down. And of course, she internalized this, that bringing out her book, what if I haven't got it 100% right? What if I don't have every post covered? And now what's happened for her is somebody else has written a book, which she says is not brilliant. It's not nearly as in-depth as her book was, and because she was the pioneer of that particular element that she wrote about.
Uh-huh.
And she's feeling she's cheated herself. She's feeling now shame on her that she didn't have the courage. So, you know, shame is a huge one. And I don't know about you, but it was never anything that was ever looked at me in my recovery process at all. It was never mentioned. Now, I'm not blaming any therapist. I'm just saying that, you know, we didn't know, but maybe now we need to be getting to know this.
I agree, Christine. I think shame is something that's completely overlooked in not only the graduate school curriculum, but also as relates to intergenerational transmission of psychological abuse. And, you know, for individuals who are in the recovery process and reclaiming their self-worth, a critical component of that healing process is absolutely reclaiming their worthiness and examining the shame. So I agree with you. I think you're absolutely spot on. And I'm so excited that you're writing a book about this, because really there isn't much out there at all on the subject, specifically as relates to co-narcissists or survivors of narcissistic abuse in this particular area. So it's fantastic that you're leading the charge with that. And you're not only a clinician, but you're also a survivor, which makes it very potent, very helpful, and very applicable. You know, your first book, The Three Faces of Evil, incredible, very well written, very helpful. Do you have a website or something that would know where we can hear more about you and where to find your fantastic trainings and writings?
Well, I have a website, and it's called narcissisticbehavior.net. And on there, my book is available on there. The ebook is available through, you can download it immediately from my website. There's a physical book. People can email me and I can get a physical book out to them if that's what they want. Also on my website, I actually recorded three of the workshops that I brought around Ireland to therapists. One literally is looking at the narcissistic mother. One is about given over to gaslighting, which if anybody doesn't understand, it's to do with the ambient abuse and the coercive control that the narcissist uses to get control over their victims. And definitely clinicians should really, really look into that for themselves. It's important. So there's three workshops on my website that I recorded that I took around Ireland. So they're available to download immediately as well.
Fantastic.
The book that I'm writing at the moment, I'd love to have it out around Christmas. I'm heading for that time. Hopefully I'll be on target, but that will be an ebook and that'll be able to be downloaded directly from my website as well. I'm not going to turn that one into a physical book. It'll be an ebook, but it'll be substantial in the sense of pages wise, much bigger than the first book.
I think you are just amazing, Christine. I just feel so honored to be able to hear your wisdom and for our listeners to be able to get the chance to hear your expertise. And you're incredibly eloquent. You explain things in a way that people understand, and you're very eloquent in your writings as well. Plus, the people in Ireland are so fortunate to be able to be trained by you and also your clients. So you're multi-talented and you've contributed and continue to contribute so much to the growing body of knowledge in this field of narcissistic abuse recovery. And we're just so thankful for your wisdom and your expertise. I know that I learned a lot from you today and that our listeners did as well. And I sure hope I get to interview you again, perhaps next time, about your wonderful new book.
And I'd like to just say to everybody, look, I'm learning as I'm going along as well. I don't have all the answers, but I have got the knowledge of having been a victim. And I think I was able to put myself under the microscope and literally as a research to be able to see, well, you know, is that true? Is that not true? And it's quite a painful thing, putting yourself under the microscope. But it's also been a fantastic journey of recovery for me as well. So I also want to say that I do believe that all narcissists I see similarities between the victim and the narcissist. They have both been victims of childhood, both of them. Of course, the difference is that the co-narcissist is probably going to be willing to do something about it and to look at themselves and put themselves in the therapy room. Probably the narcissist is not very likely to do that, but then why should they? They're quite happy with their lives. They get their they get their needs met through hurting other people. So they're probably not going to come into the therapy room too often. So I have compassion for both. And it's not about beating one up as about making one, you know, one a saint and the other a sinner. I think they've both been beaten up and they're just responding in different ways to having been beaten up.
That's a great way to put it and certainly makes sense, I think. And our listeners, I think, can understand that as well. But I do think it's also important, like you just said, to really emphasize that the capacity to heal and grow really lies more so with the survivor or the co-narcissist versus the narcissist. The narcissist being welded and sort of fused to their ways of being and with very limited capacity for change. And that's another subject that we could even talk about another time. But I'm just so honored to hear your wisdom, Christine. And our listeners have learned so much and really appreciate your time today. And I just want to thank you and I want to thank all the listeners out there and look forward to having you back here, Christine, on The Savvy Shrink.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with you today, all of you. And Andrea, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak. And it's also very, very affirming for you to be saying, actually, Christine, I'll think about that co-narcissism. It seems like there could be something in that and that there is a difference between co-narcissism and codependency. So it's great for me to get that feedback. I also want to thank Alan for coming up with that title to give me something to work with as well. So thank you. Fantastic. And of course, what about your wonderful work, Andrea? I mean, you know, you're
thank you for asking.
Modest.
Oh, thank you. Yes,
oh, wonderful work and your book.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your asking. I'm inspired by you, Christine, and certainly I'm a therapist out here in San Dimas, which is a little community in the greater Los Angeles area, and the bulk of my practice, I work with clients who are survivors of narcissistic abuse, whether in love, work, or family. So that's my primary focus, but I'm also running this podcast to be able to disseminate more information for listeners out there on a wide range of topics that are trauma-informed, but interview a lot of guests as well about narcissistic abuse recovery, and other topics will also include maternal wellness, special needs parenting, trauma and loss, and others. And I'm also writing a regular weekly blog for Psych Central. I wrote an ebook, Soul Vampires, published in 2015, and it's specifically about recovering from narcissistic abuse in a romantic relationship, working on updating that. There's a lot that needs to be updated in that, and I will be adding a companion workbook to that as well. So keeping me busy out here.
You're a very busy.
Thank you. Yes, I'm definitely busy, but I think one of the things that's so inspiring is being in touch with wonderful colleagues such as yourself and being inspired by the work you're doing, being energized. Just so grateful for your time today, Christine, and happy that we had the opportunity to talk, and our listeners have learned so much just in the hour that we shared together today, and there's so much more to learn, so many layers. So really appreciate your time and wishing you well from the U.S. and hoping that you're having a beautiful day in Ireland over there.
Well, I'll say goodbye to everybody and thank you so much. And I'd love to come on again with you sometime.
Oh, be so honored, Christine. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.